So we're talking about Trice Tallard Howard.
Right.
Trice Dallas Howard, daughter of actor-director Ron Howard.
Shut your face!
Nepotism exists in Hollywood.
That's why she's a redhead for half of the film.
Goes from a sitting position to a carrying her position. And I watched this last night with your mom, our mom, and she noted that that's really hard to do because I'm an OT.
Yeah, like physics wise, it's bad.
Yeah, but he does. He, you know, lifts her up and he carries her out of the front door.
I'm gonna get you, I'm gonna lay you on a lounge outside. I'm gonna get you a cup of coffee. He assumes she's some drunk person or whatever, which is fine. It's reasonable. I'm gonna put you outside. You're gonna sober up and you can go wherever the hell you want. So he starts walking her outside, maiden style, we're gonna call it, and then he like sees the thing in the grass.
Right. And then he like he sees the monster, and then he slowly turns around to go back to the house.
And then she turns to the left, left.
Well,
and
she doesn't she see over his shoulder?
Well, he okay, so the creature comes up on Giamatti's left side and is like and then she sees it and she's like, oh shit. She starts screaming. He starts screaming. He starts running because he's holding her. Then the thing is behind her. And that's when she points towards the pool, I think. Not the beast, but the pool. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, ah! And then he runs into the house. Beast is pursuing. Shuts the door just in time.
Right. I do like always kind of giggle inside when they both start screaming.
No, it's funny. As yeah. It's funny. As so then it cuts to animal control. I love it. It's so f-ing reasonable. Like, there's a problem with the pool. Call the pool guy. Call animal. There's an animal in the grass. Call animal control.
Right. And he's trying to describe the animal. And he keeps saying that it's green. And the animal control guy is just like, look, it's probably just, you know, a dog that's got some mud in its fur. Can you tell me how big it was? And he was like, yeah, it was like up to here. And he like is like,
it's a Great Dane.
Yeah. The guy thinks it's a Great Dane. It's like, no, is it like a, are there any wolves or hyenas? And the guy's
hyenas, it's Philadelphia.
That's literally what the guy says. And so he's like, well, I'll go ahead and take a look around. You know, an animal of this size is gonna, you know, leave a trace of itself. And he picks up his like carrying case. And
which
he
is far too small. It is a raccoon sized case. Mm-hmm. Okay, so she's alone in the apartment. I was like, my notes are like, get her some pants.
Exactly.
But she's not. She's in a t-shirt. She finds the shower. She pulls off the shirt. She jumps in the shower. But that doesn't matter. She's in the shower. It's great. Good for you, Story. Her name is Story.
Yeah.
Have we talked about that?
I mean, it feels like he's hitting you over the head with something because of the fact that her name is Story and it starts out with a story.
It could have been any other
Like, my name is Plothole. Sorry.
Plotty McPlotterson.
My name is Thesaurus.
Yeah.
I'm like this one thing, but I'm actually a simile.
It's like this, but it's not.
My name is social media.
That's an actual thing in American Gods, though.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Good job. High fives. Okay. So we cut back to my notes say, love the college lady.
Oh, I know. Like my note was Rufio. Because so not only have we heard the word narf, which reminds me of Pinky and the Brain, but we also have this like rad black and red mohawk.
Rufio mohawk.
Yeah, it's a Rufio mohawk. So it's like, I think that's why, I mean, I couldn't, looking back on it, it's really hard to take it seriously because like my nostalgia of Pinky and the Brain and Hook with Robin Williams, I think that's why it was really hard, like looking back on it, like over 10 years later, to not really take this movie seriously because like I liked it when it first came out. But then over years of rewatching it and everything, I was like, narf, oh, Pinky and the Brain holds a higher place in my brain. And Hook with Robin Williams in, I mean, today still kind of holds up. And I mean, it's nostalgic things, but there's a part of me that's just like, I think that's why I really had a hard time taking this movie as seriously as the director does.
I don't think he takes it that seriously. And that's what makes it delicious. His hands, when you...
Are you serious?
Yeah, I don't think he takes it that serious. That's what makes it good.
Well, then his humor is very dry because it didn't feel like... It felt like he was taking everything very seriously.
Okay. So, he goes to Young Soon. She's like, hey, I got more books for you. He's like, hey, could you look up a word for me? Because obviously college students can do whatever. He's like, can you look up the word NARF? She's like, I know what the word NARF is. She doesn't say that. She goes, that's a bedtime story. He's like, "Ooh," and she's like, yeah, my grandma used to say it to me. But he's like, do you know anything? She says, I don't know anything. She's like, maybe my mom knows something. And so they go up to 16B, if my brain clapped it right.
Okay.
And so it's a bedtime story. She starts hollering at her mom, who's working in the kitchen. I don't know if you've ever tried to pull a mom out of a kitchen, but I have never tried to pull a Korean mom out of the kitchen.
I love these two. They're dynamic. They work really well together. They play off each other really well.
I love how she responds to him in general.
Yeah.
She does treat him like a landlord.
Yeah.
Even if he's just the maintenance guy. She's just like...
Well, and there's like, there are moments where this scene just fully works. Like he's taught, like there's the Korean mom, her daughter, and Mr. Heap. Daughter is Young Soon. And Mr. Heap is like asking questions. It's getting translated into Korean, then translated back into English. And like, there's a moment where the camera cuts from the two of them to Mr. Heap. And he's like processing some of the information, asks another question. And then when it cuts back,
she disappears back into the kitchen and she wallows her back into the kitchen. She's like, ah, la, 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 in like Korean, probably.
Yeah.
I don't mean la, 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 but like, I don't know Korean. And so she pulls her back and she's like, ah, she's like, mom. But I imagine she's saying like, mom, get back over here. We're not done.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. Okay. So they're looking for a vessel. There's a giant eagle that's supposed to come rescue the Narf.
So the Narf is a sea nymph, mm-hmm. and she is supposed to come down here because she's supposed to meet someone of great importance. And when the human sees her, they're going to have this moment of awakening inside mm-hmm. of them. And then she'll be carried off by a giant eagle.
That's fantastic. And Young Soon's like, she's just mad I didn't marry a dentist.
Yeah.
Because that's why I call this scene giant eagle rescue and marrying a dentist.
Which mm-hmm. I think is probably the funniest line in the movie. Yeah. I think it's funny.
Oh, but what about the next line? Because Paul, sorry, Cleveland goes back to his apartment. He walks in and she's naked in the from the shower. And he's like, could you put something back on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm so torn about this because I don't think it's really necessary. But then it's like it's Bryce Dallas Howard and I'm okay with it. Oh, which is horrible.
Are you into somebody who's got gams, Jen? Are you into? Are you?
Am I into the bottom half of the female form? Yes. Okay. Well.
Okay. Okay. So she's naked. He asked her to put something on. It's non-sexualized nudity. It's wonderful. I want more of it. Hollywood. Hey, personal request. Could we have non-sexualized nudity? Because the human body's the one thing we have in common between us, and bits and pieces sometimes are parts of that.
As long as the person is of age, because we reviewed Bolero with Collateral Cinema.
Yeah. I'm all about adult people being nude. Okay, so here's the weird... Lydia.
You reminded me that we did Bolero.
How dare you? There's a weird space between like babies who are allowed to be naked, and then there's adult people who can be naked. And then there's like this weird in-betweeny place between like someone who's become aware of their body, maybe like five until like, let's say it, 18. Like between 5 and 18, I don't want to see your naked body, right? But like a 4-year-old and younger is allowed to be like a non-sexual, like human person just existing, and I'm not going to look at your body and be like, oh, look at that penis, or oh, look at that labia. Like, I don't care. I don't want to. You're just a baby, right? And it's not that I sexualize between 5 and 18. It's just that that's such a weird transition. You don't know where you are then, but statistically, that's where you're most likely to be abused. So, like, I don't choose to absorb that in my media. After 18, like, if you happen to be naked, I mean, unless it is super sexy, I don't care necessarily for you to be a sexualized human being. So the fact that, say her name?
Bryce Dallas Howard?
I was going to say Dryce Ballard Boward. She is naked, but not sexualized. And I think that is a beautiful part of the storytelling of this movie.
I agree with you that we need more moments of non-sexualized nudity. I don't feel comfortable with any kind of nudity of anybody under the age of 25.
Hell
mostly
yeah.
Because of the fact that if you were like, oh, this is a, it, like if social media was around when I was a baby and my parents put a video out of, you know, like me running around and all you really saw was my bare, then I would, I don't know how I would feel about that. Partly because it's like, you know, there's no choice in the matter for the person who is nude.
I do appreciate, although I initially rebelled against it, I do appreciate the movement to protect your child's online persona until they are able to make the conscious decision for themselves to do or not do.
Right.
And I guess that really kind of flies in the face of what I just said. So I will amend my own thought upon new information. And although I would say 18 is probably where I say you can start making decisions for yourself, just because legally that's where you're allowed to, I would probably prefer someone older to make those decisions.
Right. That being said, when one of my nephews gets old enough for me to embarrass him with his partners, I'm probably going to be like, he used to like just take off his shirt and run around in his diaper.
My mom washed me in the popcorn bowl as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the pictures are hilarious.
Right.
That's funny shit. At least it's personal and not online.
Right. But you are consenting to it as an adult. You're like, yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like if my nephew were to come back to me and be like, Auntie, I don't really like it when, like, because one of my other nephews has actually said that, like, Auntie, he's like been, he was like, I think 8 when he told me this. But like, if my nephew ever came up, was like, Auntie, I don't really want you to, you know, talk about those things to, you know, my partners in the future, I would be like, okay, I won't. Yeah.
There was the guy that is on the cover of Nirvana's Nevermind that the music studio.
He sued them after capitalizing on that image for himself after he became like 18. So, I mean, that seems a little disingenuous if you're asking me.
I mean, like, grab your money, guy.
Yeah, but then don't maybe, you know, show your hypocrisy.
I mean, I don't know. I've never been exploited like that. I'm sure I've been exploited. I've worked for corporate America, but I've never been exploited as a minor and then like had to reclaim it as an adult. So like part of me is like, make your money.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's that kind of brings up the question of should we have children in Hollywood at all? Because of the fact that it's so easy to exploit child actors and because of the fact that they can't actually consent to this work.
Problematic.
Okay. I think we took that up to about a 9. Maybe we should bring it back to a 3.
Okay. So this movie scale is from 1 to 10. 1 being like, that's fine. It's perfectly normal. To 10 being like, you should probably put that ass away.
Agreed.
So we're talking about Dryce Tallard Howard.
Right.
Bryce Dallas Howard, daughter of actor-director Ron Howard.
Shut your face!
Nepotism exists in Hollywood.
That's why she's a redhead for half of the
She's got a lot more hair than her dad does.
Have we been recording for close to 2 hours? I don't even think we're like a third of the way through the
movie.
We're
going to rush through so much. Okay. So anyways.
It's only the second day we've been doing this. We'll be fine.
Like, yeah, we got the whole weekend.
It's Sunday.
Okay.
I have to pee so bad. Are we going to put that in at the end?
I don't care. Lady making water. Okay.
So they're in the house. And
house?
Well, it's like a side house.
Yeah, he lives in what seems to be the pool house.
Oh, okay.
I think. He's got a cute little separate living space.
Mm-hmm. Right, because he's there all the time. But I think at this point, is it here that she starts mentioning that there aren't things that she can talk about?
Well,
or is that part of the conversation with the Korean mom? Because doesn't he like get a rundown of different people?
Not yet.
Okay.
So he says, could you put something on? She is in the shower. He's like, they get uncomfortably close in a way that is not bad, I would say. Like, if you are a huge coveter of personal space, you might find it uncomfortable. But like, really, like it, I feel like it's just supposed to depict the intimacy that they have, which is instant and weird. But is weird bad? I don't think so. Not in this. Okay. So she says she's looking for a writer. And he's like, awesome, writer. Let's figure this out, you know? And so he starts going down a list.
Well, doesn't he like go through his normal duties and he's interacting with different tenants? Like there's an old lady with a cat and mm-hmm. she mentions, you know, that she wrote a book.
Mm-hmm, but that, no, she, okay, I'm with you. You are right. She was like, I need a writer. His instant thought was the critic.
Oh, that's right.
And the critic says, oh no, how about the lady you told me to talk to? What's her face? Belle? Betty? Whatever, the animal lady is what I mostly refer to her as. She hasn't written a book in 20 years. So then is it crossword guy? Well, he doesn't write except for in his crossword. So that's not mm-hmm. really the same thing as writing. She's looking for... So is it the stoners? No, the stoners have not. And they're only like the stoners by name. Like goatee stoner, stoner stoner, and like glasses stoner. Like they all have stupid stoner names in the credits.
What, one of them is UK stoner. I don't know if that's in the credits. That's probably Glasses Stoner. But that guy is played by Jared Harris. Applauders. And he...
Who the f*** is that, Lydia?
If you have seen the phenomenal miniseries on HBO called Chernobyl, he plays Legasov.
I have not.
No, that's okay.
He's in The Expanse, too, I believe.
He's in The Expanse. He's the bad guy on Fringe. He's the bad British guy on Fringe who ultimately gets like sliced in half by a portal. It's great. That was my first real introduction to Jared Harris. And I was like, oh, this guy's a great actor. And then Chernobyl came around. And I was like, oh, it's Jared Harris.
Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry.
So I've got one more on the topic of actors because the crossword puzzle guy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, tell me about, I want you to tell me in detail how you feel about crossword guy.
That's Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah.
Probably the earliest Jeffrey Wright thing that I know of, but he is prolific now. He's going to be Commissioner Gordon in the new Batman in March. And he's been in Westworld, and he was the voice of the Watcher in the What If series.
He was in the Hunger Games movie series. Yeah.
Jen?
Mm. Jen. One of the sexiest voices in Hollywood.
No, those are...
He also is a great dad.
Lady to lady.
Hmm.
Hey, yo, baby daddy.
Hey,
yo, baby daddy.
He could be. He's definitely a daddy.
He's a daddy in this movie.
He's literally a daddy in this movie. Okay. Funny as shit. Okay, so he... Okay, wait.
I would eat cereal next to him any day.
Would you eat cereal out of his belly button, though? That's really what it's all about.
I don't know, like food and sex, it just doesn't really go together.
Worked in Hot Shots Part 2.
Did it?
It did for me at 12. Okay, so he comes to Young Soon and he's all like, hey, you written anything? She's like, no, I'm multiple choice all quarter, right? But then she exposits about the Scrunts. She's like, Scrunts are a leafy bad wolf guy, something, something, bloobity blue. It's a great exposition. Yeah. We don't need to spend much time. She's describing a thing he's already encountered. So then he's like downtrodden, walking through one of the lower halls towards the laundry room. And I've never lived in this kind of apartment complex because I've always been blessed with a washer dryer. Sorry.
I've been in one of those apartment complexes. At least I think I've lived in two of them. So.
So he's walking down towards that. He comes across Vic and his sister, whose name I did not write down because I'm a jerk. But Vic is M. Night Shyamalan.
Yep. And like, I love the banter between the two of them. They definitely feel
between
like a brother,
brother, sister.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, and then Mr. Heap just blurts out, like, he's like, oh yeah, the light above my desk is off. And he's like,
Vic,
oh yeah,
says that. Vic says that.
And then Mr. Heap is like, yeah, I know I need to fix that. Oh, hey, how's the writing coming?
And then he's like, he has a light bulb situation of his own, for sake. Yeah. Maybe that's too heavy handed. But that's the thing about this movie. I don't mind the heavy handed.
It's hitting you over the head with a with a double-edged axe.
I do not mind. It worked for name the Jen. You can insert it in the edit, but like the whatever gnome was in Ghibli. Gimme.
I love how that just trailed off.
It really did trail off because I can't remember the name of the gnome. Dwarf. Madeline's going to yell at me so bad if you don't edit this really
good.
You
see, that was a Gimli, and you said Ghibli, and I was like, okay, she's talking about Howl's Moving Castle at this point.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about Gimli.
Lord of the Rings.
Double-ended axe. So we cut from him realizing that M. Night, Vic, is the guy, to a story stealing junk from her.
She's just grabbing random stuff.
She's like an armful of junk from Miranda's apartment until she finds his notebook.
Mm-hmm.
If you found my notebook, you know what you'd find?
10 pages of writing about Lady in the Water.
Garbage pages about everything we've looked at in the last month.
At this point, I'm like, okay, writer, director, you chose yourself to be the writer in this movie? Maybe get a better director.
Writer, director, producer, Jen. Get it right. He's a triple threat.
I got triple threats for all three of us. So she starts reading his personal journal from whatever the but it cuts back to Paul, Cleveland, who is, you know what the thing I like about him? He's doing his job and then doing a follow-up. He's in the stoner's apartment. He's like, so you guys written anything? And they're like, no, we're f***ing stoners. And as much as we are emotionally invested, we have not done sh- for sh-.
I write stories every night in my head. And that's how I get to sleep. Mm. That's how I know I wouldn't be a good writer.
So he ends up back at his own apartment. Like the stoners don't amount to, like applauders, the stoners don't amount to anything. Are you surprised?
Mm-hmm. I would, pointing out here, a little bit, because we haven't really pointed it out, that Cleveland has a stuttering issue when in his speech. And that goes away when he is around Story, but he does stutter around the tenants when he's talking to them.
Yeah, but they don't mind. And only at one point in this, I don't know if you've been around somebody with a stutter. I've been blessed to be around a few. One guy, oh my God, when I worked at Highline, there was this guy who came up to my window and he was pissed as f***, right? So that like exacerbated his stutter. And I was like I was his cashier and I was like, And I learned just enough to know to not correct or substitute words for somebody who has a stutter, right? And he was pissed and he was mad and he was telling me everything he was mad about and he stuttered through a lot of it, but he was sexy as and had a stutter. And I was like, oh, you can't see it, applauders, but my face is like wide-eyed, open mouth, like, uh-huh, yeah, anything you say. And I'm sure he took it as me being like, oh no, a guy with a stutter. But it was me being like, I would like to put my mouth on your mouth.
Totally married at this point.
Super married at this point. I also had like a conventionally like super Nordic attractive guy come up to my window and be like, hey, I have all these parking tickets. That means I cannot get my grades. And I was like, yeah, and you should pay your parking tickets because you need to get your grades. I don't care about like conventionally Nordic attractive guys with like stark blue eyes and like sandy hair and like well-built. I don't give a shit. But like the guy who was just like, I can't, I was like,
Here's an interesting thing to about stutters and in some cases Tourette's is the person, if they're studied in like music or a speech, as in something that you've rehearsed over and over again, you can get around it. It's a different part of the brain. So Paul Giamatti being around Story no longer has his stutter in the same way that an orator being around his own story might not have that stutter.
Oh, that's a good observation. That's a good thought.
Okay. Shyamalan puts himself as characters in his movies. Like, it's always just that. I feel like he's putting a lot of importance on this character and how he sees this specific character, which is himself. And I think that's kind of why this movie probably didn't hit people as well as it could have, because of the fact that he's the director, he's the writer, he's the producer, and now he's the most important person in this story.
I...
Or, in the world of this story.
I respectably disagree.
Okay.
This is because he has, yes, set himself up as to be the vessel. He is the vessel, according to the lore of this film, right? But then, as opposed to him then being the
central focus of the actual film.
Yeah. As opposed to him being the central force of the actual film, he is, like, told with, and we haven't gotten there, we're going to rush through so many pages, but he has been told, hey, you are doing this amazing thing. You are the vessel, right? But then, you know what? Vessel, hey, look, you are the thing that pours into another thing that is more important. That it, I mean, a vessel by its very nature is what that is. Like, you are not the most important part of this story. You are the thing that gives to another thing that is more important later on to yourself. And I think God bless it. We are all very, very special and we all very, very important. But who we affect and what that creates later on is not as paramount as we have been led to believe, you know? And I will scale this back and make it part of a podcast, but you and I and everything have been told that, oh no, you are the hero of your story and whatever. But really, if you are given yourself reasonable aspirations, like the people you affect are going to echo into history. And so M. Night Shyamalan is given this fantastic role. Hey, how fancy are you? Right. But he is limited. He is given parameters at least three different times to be less than apex. You know, he's not the lead of this story. He is not lead of the next story. He is lead of three stories from now, and it has nothing to do with him. He has been promised very finite things. And I think that's pretty, I mean, as far as this movie goes, written, directed, produced.
Okay. I still kind of disagree with it, partly because of the amount of importance that's put onto him. I feel like if, and this may not make too much sense in the way that the story has been written up to this point, but I feel like I think the next scene that we see with the writer,
uh-huh.
Where the writer is actually introduced to story and sees story the first time, I feel like if it cut off at that point, I would fully agree with you on that. He's been inspired to create something. And when Mr. Heap goes back down to, so Mr. Heap goes to fix the light bulb, and he says that he was like, oh, by the way, my ladder, swoosh, swoosh, knocked the
he fakes it so hard. Yeah. He snoops.
But he says that it his ladder knocks over part of his manuscript. And he was like, I just saw the title and it said cookbook. And, you know, Vic is like, yeah, it's just a bunch of my different thoughts and everything. And, you know, it's how I see the world, which is essentially what art is. It's like a reflection of yourself. But, you know, it's even though Vic is downplaying it, it's still like the words that he's saying, it can have a lot of weight to it. Because like what, and we find this out later, but even still, like at this point in the movie, it still feels like, you know, we've already been told that he's going to be inspired and he's going to do great things, mm-hmm. after he sees story, and he's going to, you know, this spark is going to kind of
like
come up
in him. Needles.
Right. And that comes up into the scene where Vic goes into Cleveland's house-ish pool home. And I don't know if that's like right after this. I'm probably skipping something.
It's happening next.
Right. And he sees story, and that's when, you know, he gets those pins and needles.
Because they have to look at each other for it to be a thing.
Right. But I think if that was the last scene where we saw with him, I would be in full agreement with you, because I feel like there was an aspect of this movie where Shyamalan is also trying to talk about how the collaborative nature of storytelling and just essentially art. I mean, you see all these different people have to come together in order to kind of fulfill. Like, do you know how many people have to come together in order to make a movie? It's a lot.
I mean, who hasn't watched Debbie Does Dallas?
I haven't. But
I haven't either, but apparently there were a lot of people coming together to make that happen.
Sex joke. But what I'm saying is there's a collaborative nature to storytelling. And even if you are, let's say that you're an artist who lives essentially in a void away from any other people. And you're the only one who's making art. You're the only one who's taking in the art, but you still have to live in an environment that allows you to live. There's still a collaborative element to the art that you create because of the environment around you.
That's fair.
And I feel like if the emphasis on this movie was more about that collaborative, then it would have been like, yep, this is the writer. He's the important part. And at this point, he does not need to be in the rest of the film. And it would ultimately be about Heap and Cleveland and Story, you know, kind of coming together and him realizing what he realizes at the end. And Story, it, you know, goes on and flies free, little bird.
Okay.
Okay, but it's called The Cookbook.
Not The Anarchist Cookbook, Jen.
But isn't that pretty much what The Anarchist Cookbook started out wanting to be? The desire was to have some words that would inspire somebody to change the world.
And hasn't it?
As much as the Unabomber's manifesto.
We go to the apartment of Heap. We go to the apartment of Heap. She is... My notes say, this is the first time I really think that we are in all caps in my notes, which is saying something because we've watched some films where my all caps happen so early, right? I forgot about the sad backstory of Heap.
So is it after the writer leaves that she says, I read your journal?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He has a dead wife. He has dead kids. We don't know. He wasn't home. House got broken into. He lost his wife and kids. He wrote about it in a journal. He wrote the most beautiful words for her to read. She says to him, all beings have purpose. She's like, you don't feel like you have purpose, but all beings have purpose. And that's when he's like, hold on a second. I have someone at the front door who I want to introduce you to. And that's when he brings in Vic. And Vic looks at her and she looks at Vic. And he's all like, tinglies. And she's like, tinglies. Is that all that's necessary? Yes, we are done. Between the two proverbial people who we should feel like are the main characters of the story, we get this vision. I like that it's done. Like, I'm good. Like, they don't have to talk anymore. They kind of peripheral each other, but it's basically done between the two. And I'm cool with that 100%. Also, I would say that this is M. Night Shyamalan's humble trip. As far as being in charge of everything, he could blow this all up his own ass. And he's like, hey, I am at best a secondary character, but probably more likely a tertiary character. And we can disagree about that. And you may go now.
If his last scene was this scene, I would disagree with it. But because of the way that it plays out later on, which makes sense in the movie that we have seen so far, you would have really had to rework the beginning in order to be less focused on certain aspects, which would be really hard to do because there's a lot that's kind of getting thrown at you. And I think it's organized very well in the movie. But it's just the way that Vic's interactions with Story later on lead me to believe that it doesn't come across humbling for me.
Oh, like he needs too much of a pat on the back afterwards.
Well,
like too much closure?
No, you don't really need the closure of the writer. And when we get to it, I'll expand on it. I don't want to necessarily do it because we're early.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll talk about it later on. But basically, tingling, Cleveland's like, there's a tingling. And then he goes, and then Vic leaves. And then Cleveland's like, I think that's it. I think we're done. And
okay, can I say?
Yes.
This is a character trait of Cleveland Heap is that he delivers something that I have appreciated only as an adult, which is quiet correction. I am not good at getting yelled at. I am not good at getting like, here's your quarterly review. Like, I am not good at that because it is very severe and it cuts through me and only tells me I'm a worthless human being, right? But at least twice now, he has proven himself to be a quiet correction giver. So when he is in the hallway with Reggie and he's like, don't work out in the hallway, right? And Reggie's like, fine. And then he turns around and he says, because people might trip over all your, you know, your workout. Like, I can't, you shouldn't do it. And Reggie's like, got you. Right. Well, in this scene, she's reading his diary out loud to him, but it's something no one has seen and no one in the apartment complex recognizes. They don't know. They don't know his history. So she's like, your wife and your children are dead. And your words are so beautiful. And he leans in close and he takes the book and he says, don't read this anymore. Don't, no one here knows. Don't say anything about this. She doesn't really say anything, but he takes the book from her. He walks away. And it is that kind of subtle, what my notes call quiet correction, is kind and beautiful. And I welcome that. I wish I had more of that. We are not in a culture that gives that very well. You know, like, when's the last time you've been told how to do something better that didn't feel like a slap in the face?
I will say that most of the correction that I've ever gotten from a human being that didn't feel like a slap in the face has come from you. Yeah. Like, I like, and sometimes it's not always very overt. It's like, have you ever been like you and two other people? And one of those other people is a person who's doing something and you say to person number three, hey, it's really shitty when people do this sort of thing. And it's kind of like, you know, you're not directing it towards a person who's doing something shitty. It's like, you're kind of like putting that information out there. And there are times that I think you've done that, and it's, and you may not have been doing it specifically to address it to me.
Well, because I think you're perfect.
Well, thank you. I'm not, because I'm human. But it's one of those things where it's like, I feel like there are moments where you've done that, but then there are other moments. Like, I can't think of anything specific, but I would say that you and just this family in general, like, there's been correction and it doesn't always feel like a slap in the face. So I think that what you're saying about Mr. Heap being gentle with his correction is a very good character trait. And it makes me, it speaks volumes to him as this, you know, guy who works at the apartment complex, because he's maintaining it. He's, you know, like, he even says, yeah, it's my job to do that. You know,
I think that to feel like you're being guided to being a better person. And this is not how it has always felt, but it should be something that is like, it should feel like learning. It should not feel like correction,
mm-hmm.
You know? And I feel like he is, I don't know if it's his background as a doctor, because we find out that he was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe in this last scene we find out, but he...
Right.
It's a beautiful aspect of his character.
And correct.
It's so rarely seen. Can you imagine? Feel free to take several minutes. Can you imagine or remember any other gentle or quiet correction you've seen in another film?
I would take several minutes, but we were already several hours and days and weeks into this podcast. So I agree with you on this level. I really like how, again, his character, this is characterization. He's a gentle corrector. He teaches. And again, it speaks to that, you know, he's more of a father figure to Story,
he
not
really
a romantic
is,
one.
Because he's like, she's just a kid. And that from that second on, she never was a sexual creature to him.
Not to him.
No.
To other people, because there's mention.
Okay,
anyways.
So he takes the book away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we go to the scene I call Don't Tell Him I Told You.
Yeah. Is this the one where...
He has to go fix the toilet in the one lady's room, but they already called a plumber. And so we just find this kind of like 50s aesthetic,
mm-hmm.
who's just like, Harold's in the toilet and he's just letting one go. And like, we don't know.
Yeah, his wife is saying all these different things and he, you know, things that he wouldn't want, very private things that he wouldn't want someone else to know. And she always ends what she says with, don't say I told you.
He's gassy. Don't tell him I told you.
Yeah.
Like Fran Drescher's like third cousin.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So he already called a plumber to fix the toilet. This is mainly just an introduction of the character. And then she's like, oh, I can leave tonight now that she's met M. Night. Now that she's met
Victor.
Victor. Now that she's met Vic. She can leave, but now he can't watch her leave. So he has to, like, take her out there and then, like...
Yeah, arbitrary rules are arbitrary.
Yeah. Okay. So he leaves her on the side of the pool. He walks her into the other side of the pool. We don't realize later, and I'm sorry, applauders, but like, he can just turn around. He doesn't have to leave her side.
Right.
But that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. That's fine. He like walks to the other side of the pool. She waves a really sad goodbye. He picks up garbage and then he goes on garbage duty. He starts walking up the several flights of stairs. He's collecting garbage. She should be collected by some magical evil. Nope, not evil. She's not evil, applauders. She's supposed to be collected by a magical eagle. And then he hears noises. He runs back downstairs. Her legs are cut to sh.
Yeah, she is like trembling just inside the door of the apartment complex at the bottom. And she is just, she can't, she's so terrified she can't talk.
Right. So he's like, who did this? What did this? Are you okay? And then the scrunt.
If you're paying attention, you'll see behind him is this window in the door.
Yeah.
And there's this like figure walking around in the back. Uh-huh. And then he busts through and you know that's the scrunt.
I straight up jump scared for the first time in several years. Right, Jen?
It was a literal jump.
I was like, I was like, oh my God. I was like, oh my God.
Our TV has a weird software glitch in it right now where it sometimes slow-mos. And when I was watching it, it was a little bit more terrifying because it was like, it glitched right there at the jump scare. And so instead of having like this, where you're typically when you see this creature, it looks very CG. Like even for the year 2006, it looks very CG. But in that moment when the TV glitched, it was like almost puppetry.
I was just trying to decipher my notes right now. And after jump scare, I said, Pangit, which is actually me writing the words, dang it.
Do you want to know the note that I have at this moment?
Yeah.
Attack of the grassy knoll. Because like earlier I had
this
a note.
This scrunt is JFK. This scrunt is JFK.
Well, actually, that was a note earlier when Young Soon was talking about like the scrunt is like this like hairy mound of a wolf and everything. And I was like, now we know who killed JFK. It was bad.
Pew, 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 pew.
I don't want no scrunt.
I don't want no scrunt.
A scrunt king is a wolfy, grassy guy who can't get no love from me. Okay, so your face doesn't look right is one of my your face doesn't look right is one of my favorite phrases. But then it's poison. Okay, so we find out from Mrs. Soon. It's not Young Soon. It's Soon's mom.
Right.
But
first he goes ahead and takes Story into the apartment of the writer because
right.
he doesn't, nobody else knows her, and he's going to be the best person at this point in the story.
Yeah, she's yeah. sleeping on the girl's bed.
Also,
the sister's bed.
Yeah, also, his sister makes the comment of Mr. Heap is a playa.
Gross.
Yeah.
But accurate. Okay.
Right.
So he
goes back.
Yeah, he's got to go back to Korean mom. Is this the phone call at the club?
I want to say no. You want to say no? Okay.
I don't remember. What we find out is that scrunts have poisons that hurt narfs. Narfs have key mud that they keep in their homes that will heal the wounds caused by the scrunks. Tartunics are a mythical.
And you think he's not taking himself seriously even at this point? Because like this was a note earlier on that I made that I didn't mention. But oh no, this was the later one. This is the note that I made at this point. So I think this is the phone call where she thinks like, oh, my mom thinks I'm at a dance class. Because I think later on, that's when we hear a specific phrase that I don't know. I don't know how to feel about it, but I think this is the moment where he's doing the phone passing back and forth because
it feels like that's what it is, because he needs to get the key mud and that is paramount in this moment.
Right.
Phone back and forth. Mm-hmm. My notes really just say Korean moms. Yes.
Yes. Well, and this is where we learn about the Tartugic that are like apes that are supposed to keep they are so evil. They kill their parents at birth, but they keep the peace.
I'm fine with Tartunic monkeys.
Okay. It's just the reasoning behind it that
here's where
me.
We're at. My notes are like, no hesitation, he jumps in the water.
Right.
oh, I was like, oh, Aaron Cups, that's great. Like, because I watched, what was that one movie, Jen?
What was the movie Mel Gibson made that I hate, but also Cups of Water, but it's Cups of Air this time?
Signs? That wasn't M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, that was. Mel Gibson, there are aliens, the cups go on to...
I have to tell you guys right now that every time you have said Signs until exactly right now, I was thinking of The Happening.
The Happening just sounds like the worst English as a second language title. Like, it's The Happening right now.
What? No.
The everything is The Happening.
Right. Okay. So Mr. Heap goes down into her little aerial cove. This is where I was like, I want to be where the people are.
I guess it's a guess and plenty. I have who's this and what's up galore. I stole okay, all we of don't this need, shit from the pool
We don't
side.
Need you to go through every line in the song.
But who cares?
So he finds the mud. It's like under a rock. It's
what?
Under a glass that is being kept up, that is being up there with a rock.
But the mud is a rock.
This is the part where our mother said, that looks like a shit padabi. And I was like, that's redundant. Yeah.
That's when I walked in last night.
Yeah. But he, oh, no. Yeah, oh no, tension has to go up, and you know he's losing air, and how is he going to figure out the air situation?
Okay, you can find fault with this scene, and I super want to skip past a whole bunch of it, but you know how much fault I normally find with people holding their breath in scenes. They solved it here. Mm-hmm. M. Night was like, girl, I got you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not upset with drinking or like breathing in the air from the cup. I like that. That was a very good one. And he like, you know, is like, oh, that's where my note was like, oh, that's quick thinking, Mr. Heap. And he gets the mud, he gets out. And that's when he goes and takes it back to Vic's apartment. But I think that we also have Young Soon coming back from...
This is where we learn... Because my mom found out that I was at the club and not talking to you. I wanted to tell you, and this is paraphrasing, but there's a Madame Narf.
Okay, how can you take yourself so seriously and then have phrases like Madame Narf? Madame Narf. She's the one who's going to be leading the sex workers of the sea because they're all sea nymphs. Why didn't they just keep the name Nymph? I mean, that's like
Madame Nymph or Nymph Narf.
I mean,
Nymph Narf.
Madame Nymph doesn't sound nearly as weird as Madame Narf.
Nymph Narf, are you Nymph Narf?
Okay, that's and she also exposits that the only reason why a scrunt would break the rules is because this Narf is supposed to be like the Madam Narf and like the one who's so important. And
can I spoilers you?
Yeah,
because that's why he didn't when he that might just happen just now. But like he's supposed to be the guardian. Peep is supposed to be the guardian. But he doesn't get responded to as the guardian, but that's because she's the Madame Narf. Doesn't that excuse what happened out of...
Okay, so we also have additional information at this point that's like, oh, you're going to have a guild and you're going to need a healer and you're going to need a guardian and you're going to need to collect all these different, you know, NPCs.
That happens half a page from now.
Oh, really? Because I thought that... Okay, so...
So Young Soon, which is... I will note the first time I wrote down her name right in all of my notes until now.
Doesn't she sound like King of the Hill's neighbor wife a bit? It's not the
you
same.
You think it's Laotian, her accent?
It's, yeah, well,
They were Laotian. Laos. They were Laos.
Yeah. Well, it does, it to me, it doesn't sound very Korean, but...
I've listened to a shit ton of Korean. And I'm still not an expert. So what I like about this scene is Young Soon is like, I feel like we're connected because I want to believe what you believe.
Right.
And
that's
I think
the important part.
That's cute as
that's
saying you want to cuddle.
Yeah. Like she's someone who's, you know, going through college, but she still has this like, I want these sort of things to be real.
So Story has said that. Said as much as she could, but Young Soon is like, oh, no one can tell you, no one knows who they are. Oh, yeah. She says, in fact, no one is ever told who they are. But then my notes are like, can someone else tell you who you are? Which mm-hmm. is the remaining part of the plot. Right. So he comes to Story and he's like, I think you're a fancy fidget lady. And then I'm like,
she has a bit of an existential crisis. And this is where we start seeing her kind of breaking the rules, because the rule is she's not allowed to tell anything. But she tells Vic about the importance that his story is going to have in the life of this child. And she's like, that this kid's going to, you're going to write this book. It's going to be prolific in this kid's life. And I do like the fact that they don't make it like this book is going to go out into the world and it's going to inspire all these people to start, you know, changing their lives and everything.
Yeah, it's not about your balls, my guy.
Well, no, what I'm saying is the art that we consume doesn't inspire us to make immediate changes in our life. Like you play a violent video game, it's not going to inspire you to go out and start shooting.
Yeah.
It is more than likely a reflection of who you are as a person. And so the media you consume is more like a reflection of who you are. In this case, they're kind of saying that this book is going to be important to this kid at a very early age. It's going to be discussed a lot in his family. So it's going to be a book that this kid's grown up with. And how often do you grow up with a story and it just spoke to you on some levels? And I do like that moment. I just wish that maybe the director and the writer and the producer was not this linchpin in the world of this story, because it feels like he's filleting himself like, my art's so good, I'm going to... Sorry.
I think that's hilarious. And I'm super glad that that might be the first time we've used the words in filleted.
So now if he just went full camp and just like, because he's saying things like Madame Narf, if he went full camp and didn't take himself super seriously, mm-hmm. I would probably have enjoyed this movie for longer than I did.
I said it's, my notes are much more forgiving.
I know.
It's not about Vic, but about someone he inspires.
Yeah.
I want it to be Jeffrey Wright's son.
Okay. Hey, look. It's a pool party with Reggie.
You're now 2/3 of the way through our review of the walkthrough of 2006's Lady in the Water. And we've still got quite a bit of plot to discuss next week, along with our shocked and applaudable moments. Looking for even more great lady-led shows? The Frolic Network has you covered. Rebel Girls Book Club examines stories that feature rebellious heroines through an intersectional feminist lens. And Book vs. Movie is a podcast that ponders the question, which was better, the book or the movie? You can find these shows and more at frolic.media, or check out this week's release description for links to these shows. Hey, this is your audio engineer and the actual baby who is on the half tip, Jen. Do you think you've got an amazing grasp of the English language and are looking for someone to strongly agree with you? Your reviews on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser.com, and ShockedAndApplaud.com help us reach new listeners, and we'd love to know what you think of our newest episodes. Why not tell the world the fabled story of how you found us and what you do while listening to our epic takedowns of Tinseltown? We'll return next week with the conclusion of our discussion of this M. Night Shyamalan fantasy thriller. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.